This podcast was sponsored by me, paid for by me. Listen, I'm working on right now on buying companies, Amazon companies. I love buying companies. It's fun. It's amazing. I love this thing. If you have a brand that you think we might want to buy, go to aaroncordovas.com/valuation for your free business valuation. This is also sponsored by Samurai Seller. It's our ad software, the new Amazon ads automation tool. We just released it. This thing is fantastic. And I'm telling you, I'm sponsoring you to get a free run of our software. Sign up now for a 14-day trial. And I'm telling you, I will guarantee that we will improve your advertising efficiency on Amazon in your first month. If not, you just ask us for your money back. We'll send it to you immediately. I want to save you money. Come on. Go to samuraiseller.com/start.
This is the Aaron Cordovez Show.
Mr. Scott Needham, the man, absolutely, officially the smartest Amazon seller in the room. Okay. If you guys don't know that, that's from his a tagline from his podcast, extremely huge Amazon podcast. And so we have a massive seller here. Both are private label and wholesale or resale or however you want to call it. Scott, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you. You know what? You may call me that, but when you talk and when you post and you write about what you experience in your selling, Aaron, I pay attention. It's kind of like I got really good at the wholesale business and kind of focused on it for like 5-6 years. And then you get intrigued by what's different, what's next. Yes. And so my private label business is a fledgling. It does a few million a year. So it's nothing, it's not an empire, but, I'm having fun learning that. And then obviously on the side, I just do a lot of software with Smart Scout and all that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, brilliant. Well, thank you. Thank you for the compliment. And I'll tell you, the wholesale business is kind of difficult, honestly. I don't know. I mean, there's pros and cons to both. And we talk about that a lot, but you knowing both of them and a lot of people who do wholesale, they want to do private label and a lot of them never try and never start. So one thing that sets you apart from these big wholesale Amazon people is you were like, hey, this private label, it's like a shiny object, but it's a shiny object that's worth pursuing. Yeah. And let's try it out. And so I know, you publicly did that and acquired a brand. And so I think you talking about the differences, experiencing a little bit of both would be quite helpful to a lot of people.
And actually, there's a few bridges between the two communities types of sellers. And I think one of the best is the largest wholesalers out there and actually what they do. Mm-hmm, I'm talking about like there's dozens. There's more than like people would think, but I'm talking like Recon Brands, Pattern, Caspian.
Spreetail, or is that Caspian as well? I don't know.
Spreetail. Yeah. Large wholesale. You don't even have to be that large to start doing this. But they get exclusives and then they start to act like private label. They have to really invest in these brands and help them succeed on Amazon. Pattern does that's all they do. They do.
Yeah, they're the number one seller. If you go to seller ratings, they are number one.
Yeah. Right now. And actually they have multiple seller accounts. Like what you're seeing there is not all of them. They did over $1 billion in revenue last year.
Wow.
And they do these exclusives but they have a really polished team, they're 20 miles away from me right now.
And really? Wow. And where is that?
Lehi, Utah. Okay. And I've got friends that work for them. I've got ex-employees that work for them.
Spies on the inside.
Yeah. And
that's pretty good.
They pay really well. And so they have these professionals that work with really big brands and want, and they have to help them succeed. So they do a lot of private label tactics. They're investing in their advertising. They're doing, listing optimization. And actually the number one skill that wholesalers bring is actually what they call channel management, channel governance. That's where they will kick off.
Stop other resellers.
Yes. Yes. That is a big part to,
keeping. Like what percent? How much is it like stopping that? Like what percent? You say like 20%, 50%, 10%? Like how much of the work is that?
So what do you mean?
Like, how much of the, let's say, time or effort goes towards stopping other resellers from coming?
It's probably 10, 20%.
Okay.
But it makes a huge difference. You can't effectively do an advertising strategy if you don't have the buy box.
That's correct.
So, or if you have people breaking MAP, it's hard to like truly do that. And that gets in this gray area. There's a lot of service providers that are doing this now that they, there's probably
like Redpoint or something or whatever.
Yeah. There's 10 plus out there. There's more than you'd expect that their entire service offering is just, kicking off unauthorized sellers, you know, doing IP complaints, test buys, whatever, you know.
You know what's, I'll tell you one thing about that. I just want to comment about that because people don't understand it. And it's sometimes people do reports. So like, let's say you're a brand and you're kicking somebody off, right? If you get Amazon to enforce it, it's actually illegal. Like, because if they have illegally acquired goods, right? I don't know if you know that court case with Quality King, right? They got these goods out from Europe. Yep. It was like tens of million dollars of goods.
Yep.
And there was like Revlon or some other big brand. I forgot whoever it was. And they sued them. They said, you're selling our goods and we're not allowing you to. And they won that court case because the goods were legally acquired goods. They're real goods. You do not need authorization from a brand to sell their product. And they sold it online, on Amazon, everything else. And they won that court case. And so legally, if you got your product, right, through some wholesaler or through some whatever, through a store, you bought it at Walmart, you bought it wherever, you're legally allowed to sell it. But what happens is these vultures of companies like Voorhees or whoever that company is, they'll say it doesn't matter where you got it, you're not allowed to do it, and they'll threaten you and legal you and they'll take you to court. And so they're actually just bending the rules in their favor because if you got the product legally, Amazon should not be able to shut you down or do anything if it's legal. But it gets into this gray area where you have money and you pull Amazon on your side. And even if it's legal, you still get shut down, right? Am I on the right?
No, you're right. You're right. Like you said, there's some bending. They'll be like, hey, you know, you guys don't honor, you're a reseller, you're not honoring the warranty. And so this is, there are actually other court cases that show that like the warranty makes a substantively different product offering.
Oh.
And so like
do you know the court case? I would love to look at that.
No. If you actually get a Voorhees letter, it'll reference, like it'll document, they hit really hard that like your product is materially different because of the warranties and whatever.
Oh, because if they get the product from reseller and they send that order ID or whatever to the brand, then they're not going to honor it. And so it's a different product. Interesting. Okay.
So
Voorhees is not just breaking the law. They're clinging to a court case.
Yeah. And the thing is like, like I said, there's like this legal way to go through it. There's sometimes they just ask them like, hey, can you just like stop selling? And like, you know, some sellers will comply with that. Then the war comes in on Amazon's turf, where like you have brands issuing, you know, firing off like IP complaints, and then, you know, sellers like showing invoices. It's a back and forth.
Yep.
And sometimes it's like who just like wants it more, like who just like, you know, keeps, if you keep issuing takedowns, but Amazon will fight back. If a brand is like, say they're claiming it's inauthentic.
Yep.
While they know it actually is authentic.
Yes.
Or they know that they're not actually saying it's counterfeit. They just want it. Like, you can't use the counterfeit claim to actually govern your channel.
Yeah. Yeah, correct. This is wrong. They'll what, and how does Amazon fight back? They just let your reports not do anything, or what is it?
They will actually start to restrict your brand registry abilities.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause you can't do that. Like, it's not, if it's not counterfeit, and we've had a real counterfeit, and that is sick, right? And they've caught a terrible product and the wrong packaging and our name with our logo. Like, it's horrible. It's a totally different scenario. And so you can't pretend it's counterfeit when the guy just got your goods off some liquidation deal you didn't want to go on Amazon.
So
you
know? private label, they can see similar issues, but they just kind of like a lot of it's probably more like this, like it's true counterfeit, or maybe even your Chinese supplier shows up on the listing.
Yeah, I haven't seen that happen yet, but I don't know. Maybe you heard of that. I haven't.
Well, I think we're comfortable to talk about it. I doubt any Chinese suppliers listening to, an Amazon in English podcast, but no, that absolutely has happened. And Chinese suppliers were like, they get smart. They learn. They're
smart, dude, because then you're going to lose the client and you lose that brand. And then you're going to, I mean, that's not smart.
It's short term.
Exactly. They might make more revenue that 1 month and then they'll lose their client forever. I mean, that's kind of really dumb.
Yeah. No. Especially, if the client has options, and maybe even resources and effort to go the distance to we don't need you as much as you need us.
Yep.
That's,
did you file your trademark for your private label in China?
I did not.
You should, because that's what happens, right? If in China, the trademark is first to file. So if someone files your name, you may never be able to get that brand name in China, and then they could stop you from exporting. It's a big deal. And anyone who produces in China needs to file for their trademark in China, because again, if they file first, the factory could actually get the rights to your thing in China, and then that's a problem. And so for a lot of small sellers, it doesn't matter, but we actually have, issues where someone's going to try to file and they file in this category and that category, and you just have to defend it. And so luckily we filed that way back in 2016, I want to say, but people have to come and try to do something. So that's an important thing. And I'll see if in the show notes I can put, a resource to some Chinese lawyer, or I'll at least send it to you, but
That's cool. It's important. Actually, if share it to me, I want to get that out there. That's an interesting conversation point. I like, I like a little bit of order. I like the idea that, you can trademark something in China and it gets respected, even just a little bit.
Yes. And even if maybe you can't take them to court or something like that, if someone else does that to you, that is a much, much bigger issue, right? It's more preventing that, because it definitely can happen. And there was just a case, a bunch of Chinese people filed for trademarks of different classes in the US trademarks. This just came, someone showed me the Department of Justice. They shut down all the trademarks. There was like 300 trademarks. Ours was one of them. And they filed under random categories. And so there's really shady legal stuff that they're trying to use a rule. Anyway, whatever. We're not going to get so deep into that. But the point is, the Chinese will definitely try to do a lot of different things. And I'm sure it's not only Chinese, but okay, good. So what do you like about the private label now that you have that? And are you growing, or is the brand up this year versus last year?
Well, what I really like, it's really hard. It's a unique set of challenges when you have to look at an Amazon page or a market in a different way. You have to find a way to win, because you have constraints on price, you have constraints on your marketing budget, you have inventory, where it takes longer to acquire things. It's definitely, it's harder.
Is your stuff China made? Is it made in China?
Yeah, it is. We have about 100 SKUs, and that's hard. 100 SKUs in China versus 100 SKUs in wholesale, wholly different. I'm not joking. We had 100,000 active FBA products at a time in wholesale. And if
buy boxer, no?
Yeah, buy boxer. There's some challenges that I didn't love about that, but ultimately things happened and we could manage the sell through of that inventory at the best price we could.
Wow.
And, it's just one juggernaut of because what wholesale is doing is you're actually trying to sell on existing demand. You're not really creating a lot of new demand. Mm-hmm, whereas in private label, that's one of your first thoughts is got to make sure that the demand is coming. It's here. Do I have to pay for it? Do I start to get our organic demand? And so that's fun. And I continually get surprised by little improvements here or there. But lately we're like, we have 100 SKUs. I'm like, I just want to focus on the 15 profitable ones.
Yes, correct.
You know what correct. I mean? Like, why are we stocking out on these guys ever?
That's right. Are you guys growing? Like this year, are you doing better than
last year? No, we're pretty flat.
Okay.
Some products, you know, start to do a little bit better. Some do a little bit worse. It's not my primary focus.
You got a massive tens of million dollar business in resale. So,
right. You know. I spend 2 to 3 hours a week on it, but then I probably spend 2 or 3 hours just thinking about it. I do spend about 80% of my time, you know, Smart Scout. We have 2,600 users now.
Amazing. And that's paid users, or is that just total?
Yeah, that's paid. That's paid. Okay. You know, we get 60 trials a day. And I know, which is like through the grapevine, that, you know, the big players out there, they get 500, they get 1,000 trials a day.
Wow.
They churn like crazy. That's not like those trials or those new users, they're new businesses. And
Yeah, of course, like Jungle Scout, it's product research or someone who doesn't even have a business, right? Or it's a sole proprietor, right? So on yours, you're dealing with the big boys.
Think mostly. About there's two coins to this part. And actually I wanted to hit the new sellers. And then actually I have a question for you more on like the big sellers and like the enterprise type of things. So, you know, if you just think about in America, how many people start a side business every year? Mm-hmm. It's not hard knowing that there's like 100, you know, there's more than 100 million working Americans, that, you know, about 1 million people every year, like, are starting something. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then what percentage of those turn into some sort of e-commerce style business?
I hope it's a lot.
I think it's a high percentage. I would love to know that. I would love to see, you know, of all the side businesses started every year, how many of them are e-commerce / I'm going to like put Amazon with e-commerce. Like, they can be
it's so nice because it's scalable, right? Because you could reach millions of people. You open a restaurant down the street. Unless you're like the top 1% of 1% of 1% of 1%.
A restaurant down the street is not a side business. That's a bet your like life on a small win, you know?
Isn't that ridiculous? I find it just ridiculous that people, again, look, you love restaurants. I know someone who started a restaurant here in Tampa and they just got a Michelin star, right? And that's quite a big deal, but they love food. Then they go all in and it's their life and they love it and they just love food. And so, but for money wise, even that, like, your chance of doing that is so small. And even then, you know, you get all the way up there, it doesn't mean you're extremely wealthy either. Well, right. So I don't know.
Well, let's just say 10% of people, I actually think it's probably higher, you know, want to start a brand or something that they could sell online. Yep. That's 100,000 people coming in the door. And, you know, we have a solution for them. Jungle Scout, Helium 10, there's tons of tools out there that can serve them. So that's one business that I'm kind of in. But the one that I pay more attention to is these enterprise consumer, you know, like, I was on the call with PepsiCo last week. And
Wow, that's huge.
And they're, you know, they just think so differently. And
what is Pepsi thinking about?
Well, you know, when you start to think, you know, how they think, they have big teams, they have lots of, you know, hierarchy above them. And then they have like, you know, a lot of them have teams below them. And so, when it comes to like a tool like Smart Scout, which is the kind of like a market research, a competitor research, sometimes like I'll talk about a competitor that many people may not actually know. They don't really go into the, they don't even give demos to like third-party sellers that like are just mom and pop shops. They just don't even give demos. Stackline. Have you ever heard of them?
Okay. I have, because I worked with a humongous brand, like billion-dollar brand, and I believe they used them. This is 5 years
ago. Stackline only talks to those types of people. Yeah. And they charged like $75,000 to $100,000 a year just for access to their
the same data that Helium 10 has or Smart Scout has or Jungle Scout has, right? I mean, from what I've seen, it's like, I mean, I haven't seen much about it, but you can tell me, like, is it much different or what?
No, it's not that much different. I like their solution more than so Helium 10 and Jungle Scout actually built enterprise solutions. They got Cobalt and then Market Tracker 360. Those are enterprise, you know, they charge 30, 40K for that, those tools.
Interesting. I didn't know this.
And that is actually like the Smart Scout approach. Ours has always kind of been like this, like, well, don't show me what a product is doing on Amazon. Show me what a brand is doing and like how it's trending over time. You know, say we're talking to PepsiCo. I always say Pepsi and then like they'll always say PepsiCo. So like I'm trying to train myself to like talk the way that they do. They've got a lot of bosses and they really just need to justify decisions. When they have, you know, millions of dollars on the line in like new businesses that they want to go into or businesses that they want to protect, they will spend, you know, $100,000 with Stackline just to like cover their butts. Like that, like, hey, we made this move. We invested in this product because X, because we have these two competitors that we think
this market was taking market share, or we wanted to take this market that's growing and we're not in it. So just to put it in some presentation to their boss or somebody to say, hey, this was a good move that we launched this campaign or whatever.
Yep. Their motivations have nothing to do about like ROI on like a software tool. And it's more about like covering their butts, making them look good in front of their bosses.
Can I tell you, I that is so real to me because back in 2017, 2018, I was going to go into this agency model. And I said, we need more cash flow. Our private label needs cash. I am going to go and become an agency. And I pitched to this huge agency, you know, doing probably what, $200-300 million. Brand doing about $200-300 million a year. And I said, listen, I'm crushing you in this category, this category, this category. I'll work only on the sales that I increase you. And I'll only work on a percentage. That was my pitch. I'm like, it's the best pitch in the world. I only pay you if I freaking do amazing, right? And they came back and said, like, what reporting do you have? And I'm like, look, I don't have a lot of reporting. I'll show you, like, you have Seller Central. You have, like, I don't know, I was using whatever at the time, Managed by Stats, Samurai Seller, or whatever stuff. And I said, I'm only going to work if we put it up. And here you go. In these categories, I'm beating you. And then they said, what, you don't have like a custom reporting and this and PDFs and all stuff? I'm like, no. And then they went with a company instead of me that charged them like 3% of all of their existing sales, whether the sales went up or the sales went down. So their fee was something like 10 times larger than what I was charging. And it was literally based on, it doesn't matter if the company grew or went down, but they had a reporting. They could show like, oh, these five keywords went better this week, or like, I swear to you, we lost that. And again, I'm glad I did it because I'd focus on our own brand. That was good. But we lost the account purely based on reporting. Mm-hmm. And the person they went with was a huge company. Like no results basis. Said, look, your company could go down. You're still going to pay me on all your sales, regardless of whether we go down. And I said, like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah. So, when you're not talking to like a founder that like, you know, really feels when money leaves the business, just cares. You start to like leave and enter these like different motivations. People just like want good reporting. You know, they want their job to be easier. They want to push, accountability to others. So that's why they made that 3% decision, is they get to push accountability. If Amazon doesn't succeed, it's the agency's fault. And whereas like any sort of founder that like, you know, wants to pay for growth or like wants to seize an opportunity, they'll hear your pitch and they'll get really excited. I don't know. That's my opinion, as I've, you know, worked with managers.
I wasn't the founder. It was some person that they had assigned to talk with me.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. It's so there's this enterprise, you know, market intelligence world. And yeah, but then you
and actually, your enterprise one is just Smart Scout, right? You don't have like a different branding. It's just the Smart Scout.
It's all Smart Scout. If you, we kind of connect everything together. We do charge a little bit more for some specific features like the historic revenues. But whereas Jungle Scout, they have a totally different product. They have Jungle Scout, you know, that as people know it. And then they have Cobalt, which is a separate tool and, you know, entry point. You have to go through the sales process, you know, and then they're going to quote you. And your quote may depend on how big you are.
Yeah, it's not weird. I find that
interesting. And actually, they may quote you based on how many categories you are in. And so we've always, we started in a different way, and we're bootstrapped, and like, so there's all these different reasons that brought us to where we are, but like, we just give everyone the tool for like one price. Like, here you go. You like, you know, you can go in any category you want. You want to check out electronics? Okay, go for it. Even if you don't sell in that, you know? And so that's the world I'm in. So you do, as being in the kitchen category, Aaron, you, there's a lot of name brands inside the kitchen, you know, category. And sometimes you've gone against them and beat them.
Yep. Absolutely. That's the game. That's the game, baby.
How do you think about if you're going against another private label seller, you're like, okay, I know like, you know, what you guys are building here versus like, I don't know, a KitchenAid or, you know, some of these, more established brands that actually may be doing $1 billion off of Amazon.
Yeah. Or you know, KitchenAid is owned by Whirlpool. Whirlpool does about 13 billion in sales.
Okay. So you get to think about these like monsters off of Amazon and like, you know, what do you think about when you go up against them?
So for me, you know, I have the general strategy is covered in the three P's, right? And I like to talk about that, right? It's the product, it's the page, and then your promotion, right? And everything for you to win goes down to these three. What happens on the big brands, right? They typically have a huge focus on the product. A lot of times this product is going to be more advanced than maybe I could do the first year, right? But in other cases, they're not. So like, let's say a pair of kitchen shears. They all kind of do similar stuff, right? They might look better, but you could go after a kitchen shears person, no matter what big brand the name has, because the product is not that advanced and you could probably match it. Now, if you're talking about like a refrigerator, right? You're talking about like a Samsung refrigerator, my product, I'm going to probably have to invest $1 million or $2 million to get close. It's so advanced. And so when that gap is so big, I know that if I enter that market, my page and my promotion has to be so much better than them because I have a loss. I have a handicap on that product. So whatever market it is, you have to see, can I make a product that's as good or better? So like we released this coffee machine called the Mahia, right? The Zula Kitchen Mahia. And it's doing spectacular. I mean, it is doing fantastic. It was our biggest product launch we've ever had. It's an espresso machine. It's fully automatic, right? You push a button, you can make one out of like 30 different coffees. It frosts, it does everything. It is a spectacular machine. Now, when I look dollar for dollar value, when you look at like some of these Breville machines that will come out at like $3,500 and you put mine next to it and we'll go head to head. Like I can take my machine that's $1,000 and I'll go against a $3,000 machine and there will be people who prefer my machine, right? That is like, okay, I could get there, but it took us, you know, a year and a half of product development and getting our product to be good enough to compete against a huge monster, right? Like a Breville, like an espresso, like anything like that. So what happens is as you get to the bigger brands, their product is more advanced and you have to do more than just find somebody in Alibaba and get the first person to do it. You have to develop that product because there can't be a gap, or at least not a big gap, right? If there's a gap, well, then maybe you can make it up in the price, right? So let's say some people will still prefer a $3,000 Breville. Well, if my thing is $1,000, I mean, that's ridiculous. I'm a way better value by far, right?
Yeah.
I come out with a $3,000 machine, it will smoke there. So I'm not there yet. But in beating the big brands, you can't just have a poor product, because most of these bigger ones, they're in categories where it matters. The product matters. Like, you can't go after Sony's camera if you don't have an extremely crazy advanced camera. You can't just be better at Amazon and compete against somebody with a camera, because they're specialists and they need a fantastic product. So in order to compete against big guys, you make your product fantastic and then you can go after it. Or you go into a category where it's not so much needed, right? Like, I don't know, like this thing right here, right? Whatever you call this thing, a boom or like a little thing. It doesn't matter too much, right? Like it moves like this, like it just fell off, see? Like this is maybe not a name brand, okay? So the idea is this one, it's not for a movie set. It's for this studio. I don't need to have some crazy thing that like I can wave at it and it comes and does crazy stuff for me, right? But if I'm in a movie set, I do. And the big brands will have all the movie set stuff. But a home piece of equipment, it's okay. Anyway, so to answer the question, back to the three Ps, my product, I get it as close as possible or I beat them, particularly in the value. And then I know I will focus on that page and my page will be sexier and better. And my ads will be better because we create, you know, Samurai Seller. We have the automation. We have a lot of techniques. We go in very, very deep on the ads and we do extremely well. They do not have that. They have an agency that has 30 accounts and they're one account and that's it, right? So we're going to beat them on the promotion. The page, we should beat them on it. We'll have more focus on it than they have. And then the big problem with the bigger brands is that product. You have to make sure your product is up to par. And if you do all those three, then you'll win.
There you go. I like that. Yeah. You know, it sounds like what you're saying is most of the name brands actually don't have, you know, simple products. You know, a coffee machine is a complicated product.
Yes.
And, you know, it's that makes sense. And so you do have to invest a lot.
Or in like the case of makeup, they have either an influence backing or some special thing, right? So typically these bigger brands, they've made it big because they differentiated themselves, right? So in my category, it's always with a really sexy product, right? But in other cases in makeup, it's the name, right? Like you need Kylie or Khloe, some Jenner, Kardashian, somebody's makeup, right? You want Khloe's makeup and you have it because you can talk about it and it's kind of that buzz. So you can't replicate that if you just have whatever eyeliner thing on Amazon. You can't carry that with you. So it's either the product or like the name. It's normally something that they have going. They don't just have like really good distribution, right? They are generally going to have something about it that puts them forward. And so you just match that. And again, I can't have the Kardashian from my product. So that's a different category, but you can have a product that's, you know, one third the price.
Yeah. I really think this is interesting. This layer of like, you know, traditional CPG, you know, the big guys like PepsiCo, who like, they actually launch a lot of, you know, snacks that you wouldn't know, like, oh, this is actually, so like these like very big brands and how that like goes up against, you know, the bootstrappers, the people that started their own e-commerce business. And, you know, that's where you and I fit in on that side. That's where like most of the community of like Amazon sellers are at. And both of them actually have a strength. And, you know, so it's interesting, this little intersection, you know.
Yeah, some for of me them- to put $5 million for a new product to make like a fantastic machine. I mean, I guess I could do that, but it'll be a huge investment. Like I'm not going to then now go launch 200 products, right? So. Yeah. It's very tough, but a bigger company like that, they'll put that into making that product good and they put into a marketing budget, but a lot of that's off Amazon. But you don't have to cover the customer's entire mind space and get them on their TV and all that stuff for Amazon because they're ready to buy and they could have gone there to buy that Breville. But I got an option that's just as good or better reviews. And it's a brand that they've already bought a milk frother from and it's half the price. I can win that conversation. And I just need that one space when they're buying. I don't need to like promote to them on all TV and do all stuff. Now, again, could I do that? And will I eventually? I hope so. But you could take them all the way up until that moment of buying and switch their decision. And so that's the cool thing about these, you know, bootstrap people is good. They created the demand, right? And now you switch them to just get a different brand that's better.
Yeah. And I'm sure you're aware of like, you know, when a product gets more than $50, how much more consideration goes in the purchase. So, yes. You know, like right now, a $12 product to a $17 product, I don't care that much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'll see in the conversion rates. We have products, I don't know, conversion rate, 20-30%, I don't know, 40%. It changed, right? It, when the mobile to desktop changed. But we'll have products that have, you know, sub 1%, you know, conversion rate, and they're still very good, or they have a 3% or whatever. And all it has to do is the price point. So there's so many more visits, so many more consideration, like you're saying. And that's okay, because at the end, you can calculate your revenue per session. Each person that goes by your conversion rate will tell you each visit how valuable that visit is to you. And that's a number that we keep track of, right? And we look at, because it could be $10 or it could be $100, but that kind of revenue per session is a figure that is always good to know.
Yeah, oh, I love that. That's cool. Well, I feel, you know, you just keep upgrading over there. You got this awesome studio, and I see you just talking and sharing secrets all over the place.
Yeah, man. I think it's important. You know, I came in here through, I've listened to so many of your podcasts, and I've listened to a lot of people's podcasts, and I feel like, why not share, you know? Some of us that start today will be the next big brands. I certainly hope that we'll be one of those huge ones that do hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in revenues. You know, you look at some of our competitors, right? Hamilton Beach used to do $1 billion. Now they're down to, I think, like 650 million. Really? Where is that market share going? It's going to sellers. And so there's going to be some that will rise to the top. And I just know, like, if I'm helping those guys, well, we could be friends someday, you know, hopefully, right? I don't know.
You only gain by being a part of the conversation. I can attribute so many connections that I've made with people that, like, you know, has only been from, like, you know, in the podcast or the many ways that we've tried to reach people, but it's been fun. So I look forward to seeing, I have a feeling that, you know, I talked to you in a year that, you know, you'll have a lot of stuff out there.
Absolutely. We're definitely going to keep going. And just tell me if you want to just talk about briefly, like in Smart Scout, what is like one of the biggest hacks or one of the biggest things, like let's say someone's starting or they're, you know, more experienced. What are the things that you can gain out of that tool that you're just like, dude, anybody who does this, they're going to get their money's worth immediately.
My biased approach is that, like, anyone that touches Amazon in any capacity, if you're a service provider, if you're this, like Smart Scout, like we've got something there for you that like helps you. But I'll answer it this way. If you've ever used one of those Chrome extensions, to look at a product page and then, like, you know, you see like, okay, here's like 10 products. This one does $10,000. This one does $50,000. This one does $80,000. If you have ever wanted to like add those together, be like, oh, like mm-hmm. this adds together like 300,000. Like that's what Smart Scout solves for. Mm-hmm. That kind of like that top level insight before you like want to, you know, launch some sort of accessory. You actually have a top-down approach as opposed to like looking at a product. You're mm-hmm. like, hey, turns out this market is only $60,000 a month. Mm. And then like, but like, if you look at this market over here, it's $600,000 a month. So it's a very quick way to like judge markets against each other. Cause Amazon is at it's not just like one marketplace. It's really 40,000, you know, subcategory markets.
Right.
And when people are trying to like choose one product or another, like, well, why not just like compare the markets against each other? And so that you can, you know, make a decision that you don't regret in 2 years as like, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you know, this was just not big enough. Because you're not going to create demand out of nothing. You know, people either need this in their kitchen or they don't. You know, this is a small market, medium market, or a large market. And so that's generally how we think. And we layer in all sorts of insights on top of that. So, you know, what I work on is, you know, is more of that competitor intelligence. You know, where is your competitor advertising? How well are they positioned? And so if you wanted to report market share, we actually probably have the fastest way just to be like, okay, we just added it a month ago where like you take a subcategory like pickleball paddles. Mm-hmm. Okay, here's the market share. And here's how it's changed over the last month, just as a number, like a small little percentage point. And
year over year, I'm assuming you can check how it did last year versus now.
So that's probably where we get to more of our enterprise tools. Okay. Is like those bigger trends, but our entry level solutions, our business tier, that you can actually just get that really quick month over month insight.
Nice. And one thing I like about it, by the way, one way we use it is by addresses, right? If you want to find out, you could look up somebody's address or look at, you know, there's a lot of like Amazon aggregator people, and you can actually find out all their brands. I mean, that's like, yeah. I go and like, oh, this person bought X brand, right? You know, and we're like, okay, let's see all their brands. And you go, wow, they're really crashing. You're like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. Hopefully I can buy one of these companies soon. Right. So, I look at that. I use that address data.
There's got to be a, so there was this huge market for like brands. Now, when is the market going to happen for like, for declining brands, you know?
Yes.
Like there's an arbitrage there. You're like, okay, you did 10 million in 2021. You only did 2 million this year. Well, I'm going to buy you at the 2 million, but like there's some residual value knowing what you were. So
yeah. In theory, I mean, I hope some of these guys, I don't know if you've seen, but you could look at like public stock market. You could search like a Aterian. Aterian is a public company, publicly traded. They report their earnings. They bought several big Amazon companies and their earnings are negative. Like they're losing money every quarter. Mm-hmm. And you go like, when is it? That's just crazy. How could you just lose money all the time? When you buy a company, they had a certain amount of profit margin. You buy it and now it's negative. And that's because they're publicly available. But I'm sure there are other companies that are hidden that they're declining. And now with these interest rates, they're definitely losing money. I wonder if those are ever going to go out back to the lenders to then sell off those assets. And when that'll happen. Again, I don't know if you know it more than I know, but I'm waiting. We have cash ready to buy.
I hear like little whispers and stories, but nothing real. And I heard about this, like a bunch of aggregators got together and had like a meal. We're talking like, you know, 10 to 20. I think there was a lot of aggregators and like they were just all talking about their big solutions. And someone throws out like, we're not leaving this room until we all decide to, you know, to join as one big company. You know, like I think that was kind of a joke, but like there's this sentiment like some of them are just like struggling. And I'm sure they'll have some sort of, you know, life where some work out, you know, like the brands actually had some intrinsic value and some just bought a bunch of crap.
Yeah, I think so. And again, I mean, by definition, we could be called an Amazon aggregator. That's one of the things that we've been up to. And so we're actually buying like, and we pay really good. So we'll do like a big upfront and then plus a back end. And we'll go, I mean, if the brand is good, we'll go up to like 5-6x plus, right? If the company is a spectacular company. And by the way, if anybody's listening that wants to go, aaroncordovas.com/exit, okay? Because we are buying and we know how to grow the companies. When you look at let's say, SmartScout and you see these guys declining, you're like, what? Why did you do that? It was already going. How did you mess it up? And so we're growing them anyway. I'm just putting a pitch out there since, hey, it's my podcast. I can do what I want.
No.
But just saying that. And realistically, if you do come across brands that are, you know, looking for a way out, definitely send them my way because we're very, very interested.
Aaron, you've got a really good track record. And so, you know, jumping into this little aggregator, like, I love it. I think it's really smart. And, you know, you want to work with someone, if you're selling your business, you want to work with someone that like has been buying businesses for a period of time and knows what to look for, because it's also going to like shorten, you know, the due diligence time. Like,
oh, yeah.
I think you can get a really good idea really quickly.
Oh, I'll tell you, we had a company. Hold on. Let me just give this story. We had a company we closed on, 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago, whatever it was, recently. And they had been under contract like a year ago, and their due diligence with that previous buyer was 5 months. They said it was going to be like a month and a half, and then it was extended and extended and extended and extended. And then they said, oh, our funding was pulled or whatever. And it was done. They didn't close. Then went back on the market and we said, hey, we'll get it. Here's the offer. It's a spectacular offer. We will be done and closed within a month. So we did the LOI, sent the whole thing. From the time that we started the due diligence to the money being sent from escrow was something like 3.5 weeks. Okay. The entire process, including the migration. Because at one point you go like, good, we're good for migration. Then there's a migration. There's like a lot of pieces that happen, but we are fast. There are people, again, we put offers in, let's say in January. They're still not closed now. And we think those will go back to market and we'll have another chance. So a lot of times these people are going and taking these like offers that are just based on ghost and smoke. And so anyway, we close fast. Dude, that's a good point.
Well, Aaron, have you ever done a podcast or a show that where you talk about your organization structure?
No, I haven't. Organization structure on...
I want to know the different roles that you have in your business. Not because like, you know, I'm going to replicate that, but I just like to see how like an operation that you've got like that, like what are the different pieces and like, you know, how does that actually work? Because I think it's interesting.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. That's not a bad idea. We got several organizations and they're set up in various ways, but yeah, I mean, hey, sure. Love to talk about stuff and, we'll do more stuff if you need me back on your show. Whenever. I mean, we'll talk about what, I don't know what you were talking about with these days, but man, I one thing, and again, not just to talk, since you're here, I want to just briefly talk about like, what do you recommend if someone is starting reselling, right? They want to represent brands. Uh-huh. How do you do it? I get crazy. Like if you go to Pattern or somebody, I don't know that they do these big contracts or
yeah,
I don't know how they don't get screwed over, but like they build out the listings and then they keep it.
They're a wholesaler with lipstick. I mean, and that lipstick is expensive. You know, they have a sales and marketing team working with brands, and like it's probably 50 to 100 people that are like building these relationships and getting these contracts so that like
are they long? Or do they mostly do like 1 year, three years?
I bet you they start with two.
2 years, okay.
But your question about starting out wholesale, it's kind of hard because I started a wholesale business like 10 years ago. So I don't know what's true and what's not. And, it can change based off of your starting budget, but like,
what about accounts now? Are you getting still accounts? No accounts?
No, we have more than enough, with our existing, supplier relationships.
Interesting.
So the easiest way are distributors. And there is opportunity within distributors that have catalogs of hundreds of thousands of products.
Really?
And so, you know, you can find, you know, opportunities. You run their lists on a tool and you'll be like, okay, these 100,000 products, like these 500 are an opportunity. I can make a 20% margin on this. And they do. And not to say that it's not like, you know, easy, but like, so I still am involved in this world so much that like we started a conference. It's called AMC United. It's August 31st in New York City. And it is because we were at Prosper, which is a private label / service provider focused show. And I'm there with like six, I think I was walking around and there was like six or seven like wholesalers that are like doing 7-8 figures, like big sellers. And they're like, this is not their show.
Yeah.
They're not talking
about absolutely. AMZ United. August 31st, I saw you were selling tickets like crazy. I know you didn't expect to have so many people.
No, we've doubled our expected tickets. We have 250. That's after like in the first 2 weeks.
Wow.
So, do you think someone
was going to get started would go there and meet some people, or are you thinking?
Oh, 100%, 100%. Like if I know we will have new sellers, and I couldn't recommend more. Like, you know, yeah, you can buy a course or whatever. There's like 30 courses out there. You can learn this stuff just on YouTube. But you always want to like, just know a few people you can ask questions to. Mm-hmm. I think that is like incredibly valuable, you know, find someone that started their business within the last 2 years, last year. And,
massive. I agree. I mean, hey, I always recommend going and meeting people face to face and talking to guys, and you might really help see somebody that'll help you out big time, you know? So appreciate that. Awesome, Scott. Where do people find you, and what, just like any closing words, and where do people find you?
Yeah, I don't know where I'm most active. Podcast, the smartest Amazon seller. I get LinkedIn, Instagram, I'm everywhere. I've got a team that helps like, you know, do polished content, but, happy to answer any sorts of questions. It's certainly fun to learn from people who are, you know, whether you're starting out or more experienced. That's my world.
Awesome, brother. Well, great having you. And dude, if you let me know, you got my number. So,
Well, Aaron, I've had you on the pod twice, both really good. I know we're going to get you back again. So, some of the things that we talked about here would be so great. So thank you for having me, and look forward to talking it again.
All right, brother. Nice.